Morning.
Morning.
It's good to see everyone. So, we're approaching the autumn equinox. And according to Wikipedia, the Earth is not tilted toward or away from the sun, and the length of the day is the same at all points on the Earth's surface. Oh, it isn't true close to the equator. Wikipedia is great. So the Earth's tilt is momentarily arrested. It's kind of in a balance. And though it probably doesn't appear that way to us, because since the solstice, we've been noticing the days are getting shorter, aren't they? I know when I do evening zazen and I go out to the porch afterwards, each night the sun seems to slip down quicker and quicker over the lake. So, we barely notice it, but we can kind of pause at the vernal equinox. Take a pause, take a breath, and reflect. Reflect a little bit about where we've been and where we're going. Traditional cultures, they mark the equinoxes and the solstices with ritual and ceremonies. And here at MZMC, we go on an annual pilgrimage to a remote place in the driftless region called Hokioji. And I guess we don't, we're not too conscious of its being right at the equinox, but it is actually this year. So for the rest of us who aren't going on a pilgrimage, we can resolve to begin. We can resolve to begin something new, something fresh. We can resolve to begin a daily practice if we haven't been practicing daily. We can resolve to have some mindful moments in our day. We can resolve to do some study on our own. We can resolve to study with a group. We can resolve to infuse some energy into our spiritual practice. And there's a group of us in the mornings here at Zen Center. For our fall study group, we're looking into this book and this practice, Training in Compassion, the Zen teachings on the practice of Lojong. So it's a little bit of a departure from what we usually do, but not too much. We're still reading and studying, but we're also investigating closely and working with these slogans to see if we can train our minds. And in Buddhism, when we talk about mind, we mean heart-mind. In Japanese, it's called shin, heart-mind. We don't usually talk too much about training the mind in Zen. In Zen, we give the mind a big pasture. We focus, we have a couple little points of focus, our breath and our posture, and we keep coming back to those in our formal sitting again and again. But other than that, we don't try to control our minds. It's not a control method. Alan Wallace says there's two methods of working with meditation, working with the mind, control and release. And I think actually Zen is a release method. We allow the mind a big spaciousness. And we don't try to control thoughts or eliminate them. We just allow them. We also don't cling to them or follow them or get lost in them. At least we don't try. So this practice is about working with 59 slogans. And we probably won't be able to work with all 59 of them in the however many weeks we'll be together. But we're familiarizing ourselves with them, and we're attempting to find one that works for us and contemplate it. And this 7-point mind training is from the 12th century Tibet. But I think actually Norm's done us a big favor in giving us a new commentary, kind of a Zen commentary. It's a little simpler, like Zen. So I started, it's often paired with Tonglen practice. And I started doing Tonglen about 15 years ago. I don't do it every day. It's a supplement to Zazen. It's a good supplement to Zazen, and it's the closest thing we have in Buddhism to, I would say, prayer. Okay? So as a chaplain, I sometimes get asked to pray for people. I'll get a message through email or through Facebook or phone message to pray for so-and-so. And this is usually from Buddhists that are asking me to pray for someone. So my first response is, pray? You know? And then I say, oh, okay. And I write their name down on a little slip of paper like we do when someone's died here at Zen Center, and I put it on my altar. And then I do a little Tonglen for them. I take in their distress and imagine it as something thick and hot and heavy or oppressive, and I breathe out whatever sense of ease I have, which is usually more at the time than they're experiencing. So, and it's the opposite of New Agey, sort of, you know, breathe in the light and breathe out the dark. And I'm sure there's a space for that practice too, but I'm not knocking it. But this is a radical reorientation of that way of doing things, of looking at things. So that's what you do in Lojong. Things are turned right side up, because usually the way our minds work is upside down. We think in terms of upside down. We think in terms of dualism, of self and other, and we can't help but reference everything to ourselves because of our basic confusion. So Tonglen's a practical response to that way that we tend to see things, which is that I'm here and you're there, and never the twain shall meet. Good boundaries. self-protection. You know, got to protect myself. Got to take care of myself first before I can be of any use to anyone else. This says taking care of others, you know, is taking care of oneself. So it just turns it around. And it's really a practical response to our own grief, fear, or spiritual distress, as well as to that of others. Speaking of prayer, Annie Lamott has a book. Maybe some of you have seen it in the airport bookstore. It's called, it's a book on prayer, and it's called Help, Thanks, and Wow. And she's distilled prayer into those three categories: help, thanks, and wow. So if you think of it that way, even we Zennies can pray, right? Because we say help, thanks, and wow, right? So help is obviously when all of our strategies for managing and controlling our life and fixing some of our behaviors have fallen flat, and we realize that our own will isn't quite cutting it. In fact, it's got us into trouble. So then we can just say, help, help, I surrender. And saying help to the universe, it's actually a good practice. You know, it's a practice of sort of admitting, surrendering our will, self-will anyway, for a moment. Another one, the next one, thanks, is a great one. When people ask me to pray as a chaplain, I always put in some form of gratitude or thanks for that person's life, you know, for all the gifts that are in their lives. And I think that any time we're feeling the lowest and things seem the darkest is a good time to say that prayer, to say thanks, even for something really small, like thanks for this comfy bed at the end of the day. You know, it's not so small to a homeless person, right? And then wow is the Zen prayer of all prayers. We say wow a lot in Zen because we're saying wow. I look at Tim when I say that, wow. I think we've all heard Tim say that quite a few times. Just appreciation for what is, just what is right here, right now, and what a miracle it is, an ordinary miracle. There's a Zen story about a man, I'm sure you've heard this, some of you, so bear with me, and he's being chased by a tiger. And the tiger's hot on his heels. You can feel him breathing down his neck, and he's running as fast as he can away from him. It's life and death. And he gets to the edge of a cliff, and over he goes. And he basically quickly sees there's a branch and grabs onto it. So he's hanging there, and the tiger's still just drooling on him, you know, just above. And he sees a ripe berry, a strawberry, maybe it's a blackberry. And he goes, ah, and he plucks it, and he eats it. Ah, so sweet. So that's a story, a Zen story about our predicament, about how to work with our predicament of living with death basically hanging over our heads. We're all going there, right? So how do we live? Just enjoy the sweetness. So that's prayer. My friend Nancy James invited another friend of ours, Tejo Munich, to come and give a talk in her small town in Florida. Nancy has about 4 groups that she convenes there for Zazen. And they advertised it in the local paper, and 100 people came. 100 people came, and she told that story about the tiger and the strawberry. So I see that as part of the prayer. Wow. So Tonglen and Lojong, Pema Chodron has popularized Tonglen. You're probably all well acquainted with Pema. Maybe you aren't all, but she's popularized Tonglen. It used to be a practice that was kept hidden. Actually, until the 20th century, it was kept hidden, considered to be one of the secret practices. But now it's widely taught. It is a practice that benefits from having already developed a good stable mindfulness or a sitting practice. And training the mind here means cultivating compassion and resilience. Okay. Trungpa Rinpoche said that to be a Mahayanist or a Bodhisattva in our lingo, one needs to train the mind. And what's meant by that is working with our tendencies of mind. To become confused, to get caught up in afflictive emotional states, or to get really excited about positive or joyful emotional states and cling to that. And so, and most importantly, to be tricky. We have a tendency to be tricky. Sly like fox. So let's see. So Norm Fisher calls this 7-point mind training one of the greatest texts for training the mind in the history of world religion. This is his commentary. There's lots of them. So traditionally, a way to work with the first slogan, train in the preliminaries, which is connected to resolve to begin, is to contemplate 4 points. The first is the rarity and preciousness of human life. We do that in Zen quite a bit, don't we? And we get a sense of it when we come to retreat. We feel that. How rare and precious to be able to do this practice, to be able to be a human, to encounter the Dharma as the traditional way of meaning of that. Two, the absolute inevitability of death. We just talked about that. I think I was drawn to chaplain practice because I needed to practice with that one. Being with the inevitability of death. And it's been a great teacher for me. And three, the awareness and indelible power of our actions or karma. Four, the inescapability of suffering. So within these points are a lot of the teachings, aren't they? Impermanence, cause and effect, karma, and the preciousness of human life. So other ways to train in the preliminaries are to practice zazen, we would say, and then have a practice. And another way is reflecting on everything that's happened in your life that's been difficult and how that's brought you to the present moment, what you've learned from that. That's training in the preliminaries. Establishing a regular practice gives us inspiration because we get immediate feedback from our sitting practice. We get immediate feedback. It's something we can do. That's why I started meditation years ago, is because it was immediately notable, the benefits of it. And I used to tell people that. When people would say, well, why did you become a Buddhist? I said, well, I didn't become a Buddhist. I just started to do meditation. And it was because I immediately felt something from it. I could say more about everything I felt from it, but you probably experienced it yourself. And so, you know, reflecting on what brought you to this moment and what was deeply underlying that. For me, when I first came to Zen practice, I didn't understand my deep motivation at the time. I just thought I was interested in meeting this really cool guy, actually really cute guy, which is what my friend told me repeatedly, that I had to come here and meet this really cute little Japanese guy. And she kept at me. She wouldn't, you know, she didn't give up until I said I'd come, because I thought groups, spiritual groups, were all a bunch of cults. And I didn't want to come because of that reason, you know. I had read a little bit about Zen, but so finally I gave in and came here for the first time. And indeed, I was very impressed with how cute this little Japanese guy was. And I don't mean, you know, physically cute, although he was physically cute, but just his whole being was really super cute. You know? Just, you know, really in a big way. So that was it. That was it. And I thought that's why I came, was just to satisfy my curiosity and to maybe follow up on some of the books I'd read when I was backpacking, when I was in my 20s. But actually what I realized over time is that my deep motivation was healing. It was to heal myself with the Dharma. And so that's what was revealed to me over years of practice. It wasn't what I was aware of at the beginning. So after contemplating deeply the 4 points and resolving to begin, getting back to Lojong, and harnessing the power of intention to the cause of opening up more and seeing our non-separation which is arousing bodhicitta, and I'll say more about that a little bit later. Then we begin to do the work of developing empathy and compassion using the slogans. Okay. And, you know, we do have slogans in Zen. We have a couple slogans. One of them is, every day is a good day. That's a slogan, right? You could call that a slogan. That's one I've pretty much internalized. You know, I feel that every day is a good day. You know, I've made it this far, and each day is is a good day. It's precious, whether it's snowing for the 100th time and it's May, or it's a rainy, or it's sunny and witheringly hot, whatever it is. I really have internalized that one. Every day is a good day. That one cuts right through our preferences, you know, our tendency to whine when things don't go our way, when the weather isn't served up just the way we want it. Which is funny because we're Minnesotans. And I don't know why we would expect weather to ever be served up. Another one, a slogan we have is chop wood, carry water. And is that it? Yeah, chop wood, carry water. Yeah, it's something we do a lot of at Hokyoji, actually, where my other place is. And this applies to the equality of Zen practice, meaning that working in the kitchen is not preferenced over sitting in the zendo, or weeding the garden is not beneath studying in the study hall. So that's what that slogan means, and that also cuts through our habitual ways that we think, you know. Grunt work and menial work. It's pretty important in Zen. It's a good way to work with ego, clinging. So the 59 slogans are for developing compassion and empathy and sympathy, too, to all beings. And there are two categories that you work with, the relative and the absolute. Relative and absolute bodhicitta, they're categorized under those. And you actually start in the Lojong with the absolute slogans, with absolute bodhicitta. So Norman talks about that we need to connect with the spaciousness of what we call in Zen emptiness, or the absolute, or reality, or Katagiri used to call it real reality. Real reality meaning not what we think is reality. And that in order to develop compassion, we have to rest it in that. So some of the preliminary practices are to work with your own karmic tendencies and to reflect on actions, but at the same time, what they're saying is that this compassion is a fruit. It's a fruit of the practice of resting in spaciousness. It's both the fruit and the practice itself, actually. So in Mahayana Buddhism, wisdom and compassion are always together. And this mudra that we do in Zazen with the thumb tips touching is said to be enacting wisdom and compassion. One of our hands is wisdom, I can't remember which, and the other is compassion. So that helps me, because sometimes I think, why am I holding my hands like this? For hours, you know, during a retreat, I don't mind so much with day-to-day practice, but during those long sessions, I think, my hands are aching. Why am I doing this? Oh, because I was taught how to do this by Katagiri Roshi. Okay. So it was good to read that this signifies wisdom and compassion together. You know, so... So what we're waking up to is our interdependence, which is really the same as emptiness. Interdependence, we're so interdependent that we're not able to see it. It's so close, we can't see it. So that's interesting. Dogen's phrase, to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be realized by all things or all beings. That's another way of saying what they're saying here. Is that, so we start with being realized by all beings, which helps us to forget the self, which is emptying the self, which is just aligning with what is, with reality. And then we can look more deeply into what reality is. Although I haven't had the opportunity to practice in retreat for a year or 3 years, which is what's necessary to really see into real reality. So it's a radical reorientation of our way of seeing ourselves and others. Understanding that non-separation means to love ourselves is to love others. Okay? So it's turning it around. A radical reorientation. Now, Bodhi means awakening. And citta means sometimes heart-mind, sometimes spirit of heart-mind. So arousing or awakening bodhicitta through working with slogans or any other ways that we do it is awakening the spirit to practice, awakening the spirit to and bringing energy into practice so that we have something that sustains us over time when we get to feeling stale about practice or tired or like, there's no use. I'll never be enlightened. I'll never wake up. It involves a little bit faith in your capacity to wake up. And the reason we can have that kind of faith is if we know somebody who's pretty awake. That person is an example for us, an encouragement for us. So it's about the spirit that keeps us going, doing something which we believe could happen to us. And we hope it does, along with all beings. So we're going to make this vow after the talk, where we're going to vow to free all beings. So it sounds pretty outrageous, but why not? Why not all beings, you know? Let's not just save a couple beings, like our partner, or our mother, or our father, or our best friend, or the neighbors on our block, or the people we work with, but let's just save all beings. Let's go all out, holding nothing back. Why not? It's actually a fitting response to the situation we're in life. The idea that I need to free myself before I can free anyone else is a trap. Don't get caught in it. Don't get caught in it. So this is a really brief introduction to the practice of Lojong, and I want to encourage you all to resolve to begin something. Most of you are. I know you are. Allow the energy from your activities to to awaken your bodhicitta and sustain your bodhicitta. Because we're all in this together. Exactly a half an hour. That's my... That's my time. Half an hour. I have no poetry for you, but there is a poem on your program. By Rengetsu. A poem of autumn. She's one of those, you know, haiku poets who writes the poetry through the seasons. Do you know who Rengetsu is? Any of you? Rosemary, you do, of course. Of course you do, Ben. Should I tell the rest of you who she is?
Will it be on the final?
Yes. She was a nun in... she was actually not a Zen nun. She was a Shinto nun, I believe. And she lived in Japan in the 17th century. And she was the daughter of a samurai lord and a one of the pleasure women. And so she was given to, she was adopted by a priest of a temple, a Shinto temple. And at that, and what he did, I can't remember his name, was to make sure she had an education that included martial arts and calligraphy and Chinese and Confucianism. So she was quite well educated. Up until about the age of 12, when she was given to work in a the royal family, the royal house. And then she was called back later when she was, I think, 17 by her adoptive father, and she who'd found a husband for her. So she got married, and she had children. But she lost all her children. She lost... both husbands and all of her children, they all died. So she's kind of like those early, the stories of those early Indian women who lost everything and had so much grief. Except for that, she was very plucky, and she decided to make a living by becoming a potter. And she ended up famous for her pottery, and she inscribed her poetry into some of her pots. And her pots became so popular that when she'd move from town to town, sometimes she would just slip out and skip town because she didn't like how popular she was getting. People would be saying, have you got any of the pottery from that beautiful nun? Apparently she was also beautiful. After her second husband's death, she considered... becoming a teacher of Go, because she was a master of the Japanese game Go. But she realized that that she'd have trouble, that the males of the time wouldn't be able to handle learning from a female. So she chose pottery. This is from John Stevens now, Kim. And anyway, so she's just a real interesting person, real interesting human being, and she was real generous. She would give a lot of her artwork to charity. She was comfortable hobnobbing with the rich and famous of the time, with artists and noble people. So that's Rengetsu. And as I've told some of you, if you want to order her book, you can go to Amazon. But it'll cost you $47 for a little book about this big, which I used to own. Someone gave it to me, but it disappeared. Anyway, that's Rengetsu. I recommend you look into some of her poetry. Any questions or comments before we go to announcements? Well, they were. I think in her time, yeah, for the pots, there was something physical, you know. And yeah, her calligraphy was really free flowing and beautiful as well. Stephanie.
Well, I wonder if I can try. We'll walk away from this center and think about your talk. Would I be mistaken if I felt that you were teaching at least me to simultaneously be good to the self and others, that because it is the simultaneously this that actually makes something happen, but it can't be either or these people. You also have to be good to ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah, that's fair.
Kind of a fair little snippet to walk away with.
Yeah.
Cool.
I hesitate to tell you to go take care of everyone else, and in that way it will take care of you, knowing that you're a busy working mother. But that is kind of what these teachings are saying. So. No, absolutely not. You just have to work with that koan, Stephanie. Yeah, you and a lot of people, including me.
I had a question on what you mean by trying to free yourself as being a trap. And I guess it's specifically directed to like other Buddhism branches that actually focus on that as a path. And it seems like a kind of a dualistic statement.
It is. It was meant to be. It was meant to be a provoking kind of statement. A lot of the Lojong slogans are also kind of provoking, you know. To get at where we're complacent, to where we need to move a little bit. So within the context of the Mahayana, the goal is to free all others, but not to leave ourselves out of that mix.
Because it seems like it's the chicken, what came first? The chicken.
Right. Right.
So what difference does it make?
Well, it just makes a difference in terms of your motivation and your intention. You know? Knowing that to free yourself in the Mahayana and the Bodhisattva path, to free ourselves is to free all others simultaneously. That's the vow. Of Mahayana Buddhism, that's the intention. That keeps the practice from being something that further intensifies our self-grasping or self-referencing all the time. Which is that's the trap. Is that self-referencing and self-grasping? It's just so subtle. Yeah, it's just very subtle.
Yeah,
so that's what we're working with.
Beings are free to be as they are. However they are, as opposed to, you know, it seems like not everyone
that works.
Is ready to be free.
Right, there's a good slogan.
Feel free.
Put that in a card.
Beings
are all free to be exactly as they are is a really nice slogan. I like that. I do. This is sort of something that can't really just talk about in a half an hour talk and get to the bottom of it. It's something you have to explore and practice with and read about, you know. But I really like your point. That's a good point. Appreciate that. It's the release model. Not the control model. Your model, Nathan.
I don't have a model. I'm just totally winging it.
Good. That's even better. Wow. Okay. I'll be with you next.
I was just going to say, isn't it about that compassion you're speaking of, having compassion for all beings as simultaneously as you have that compassion for yourself, because we're all suffering, right? We've all been through those struggles. And so as you recognize that the guy who cuts you off on the freeway, to send compassion to him, you're also sending compassion to yourself, because you were that guy potentially who cut somebody off, you know, on another day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is that healing of, as you heal, as you send out that to everybody, also healing yourself.
Right, and it's an activity. It's more than a nice feeling. It's a practice, and it's an activity. And sometimes it's inconvenient. And sometimes it's really difficult. But what else can we do? Just a minute, Dean. Lynn, did you have a?
Yeah, I think that when you said it's tricky. Because I think you have to almost enjoy that it's tricky. Because, like, for me, it's kind of a constant tricky, like, should I sit quietly or should I engage in this moment of difficulty? And there's so many different kinds of difficulty, and I think how each of us relate to tricky is different for each of us. And I wanted to just tell a really short story that's kind of about that. I quit teaching on the north side. I've been teaching 650 art students for 15 years. Mm-hmm. I was in a very elated pilgrimage where I drove, I think it was 8,000 miles, and did a lot of amazing things. But it was a great moment. I'd studied Emma and Tom Wong Dong Jung and practiced in it. I was driving down to Big Bend, went to Texas, and the first thing I encountered was a lot of border patrols, which, you know, I was going down there to have quiet, and I was running into this, you know, patrol activity, and it was so scary. And I headed down a little farther, and I called my friend who lived in Beaumont, Texas, and I was feeling huge amounts of fear in my body, and I'm like, I get no idea what this is about. And she said one thing to me. She said, my daddy loved going to Big Bend. And it was almost like her dad, like, popped in the top of my head, and I was practicing Tonglong Long Jump like I'd never practiced it before. It was like, oh, well, that is interesting. It's just the end of the story is. And then I got to another place where I was at, El Paso, Texas. And I thought, oh, I'd like to go into Mexico and never come back. And I went across the border into the other town, I can't think of the name of. And it's a very scary place. Where there's been a lot of violence and trouble. And anyway, the end of this story is just, it was being in Big Bend and thinking about and the bliss of such an amazing place. You're at this river where people are trying to come across and they're not supposed to be. And it was just really an amazing place to meditate and to welcome the pain of the world. It was like the greatest gift to be there and to notice that being in nature wasn't the same as it had ever been for me before, because of the place and all that it holds.
Thank you. Just a few brief comments.
Yesterday, there was an event that tickled my Buddhist funny bone. We're okay. rehearsing a piece we've just started. It's a dance piece, and it starts out with three of us on the floor, lying face up. And we sing, "Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear. Happy birthday to you." And it struck me that we're singing happy birthday. Did you feel it? To this present moment.
Thank you. One more.
A couple of things. I wanted to ask this lady. When you were talking about you want to get huge amounts of fear and anxiety when you were you saying that you were absorbing that, that it was actually something outside of yourself that you were that was channeling through you or you were receiving?
I think it's hard to know that at the moment sometimes. I think for me, I have never really expressed being that close to the Mexican border and the complexity of our lives. But I also knew a lot about the stories from that place. So, and I think I've been so comfortable in nature, it was growing emotionally in myself to allow the fear, whatever it was, just to flow before I got away from it.
The second part of my question, which really actually goes on before that, was what is the role of intellectual study in these, you know, intellectual study of the Buddhist teaching in all of these practices? And I know that's a big question, but I just wanted to sit down.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Dogen Zenji, our patriarch of Soto Zen, Japanese Soto Zen, which is our stream here, was study was very important to him, and we study here. Study is important in Buddhism, but it has to be balanced with practice. Study alone is it's okay, you know, it's good. It's better than not studying, but some of the teachings don't come alive until you practice with your body. You do the practice itself. So it's important in a balance with the practices. And there are so many teachings. It's a vast universe of Buddhist teachings. Okay, I think we should probably end here. Thank you very much.